nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Skip the formality of an introduction at all. Although I do thank everyone for coming, some old friends and some newly interested people. And today I'm going to talk about the beginnings of what we consider a new technology for both understanding proteins and modifying them towards new uses. This technology combines new experimental and new bioinformatics tools. And just to use this as a way of introducing the talk to give everyone some orientation, our method starts by analyzing multiple sequence alignments of proteins from many different species, examines the relationships that hold in between different columns, that is, between different residues in the proteins represented in the sequence alignment. It then takes this information and uses it to inform a process of experiment planning, in which certain of these species are selected as parents for making chimeric recombinants. And we take the information about the relationships between various columns and use it to decide where we should break the protein, where we should recombine them, okay, by a process of in vitro recombination that I'll describe to you. Following this experiment planning, we actually conduct the construction of chimeric libraries, chimeric DNA fragments, chimeric genes, by some novel chemical, experimental and chemical technology that we have developed. We then take those libraries of chimeric genes, express those individual proteins, and analyze their properties and learn something about the relationships between the various fragments, which fragments cooperate with which others, which fragments are necessary for some activity. And by having a family of such relationships, we can take the information gathered from expressing and analyzing these proteins and use it once again to refine our model of how the various residues, how the various columns in this multiple sequence alignment interact with each other. Sure. From you, Mark, always.
So you're assuming that you're maintaining the same tertiary structure, the same fold of the protein, correct?
That's right. So these are multiple sequence alignments of homologous proteins,
right.
Species 1, 2, 3. They could be orthologs or maybe not orthologs, but similar folds.
Before you make the chimeras, do you do analysis of packing and how comfortably the new pieces fit into the...
We don't explicitly analyze packing. What we do instead is we analyze the relationships between allowed residues in the columns,
okay,
which is partially informed by their distances to each other. So we don't try to predict exactly what packing is going to happen, but we say, in essence, if one homolog allows a certain mechanism for packing, then it's possible that it's... you could make combinations of those. Okay. So this is a rather extensive technology development, and it'd be helpful, I think, to everyone to sort of give a little motivation about sort of how we got into this. And a lot of this work begins with a crystal structure that we did about closer to 10 years ago now. This is a restriction enzyme, BSOB1, with double-stranded DNA in the active site. The backbone of the double-stranded DNA is in green. The places where the DNA is cleaved and where the active site of the protein is located are at those black spheres. It's a rather unusual restriction enzyme in that the protein completely surrounded the double-stranded DNA. It's like it formed a tunnel. The double-stranded DNA would be sitting here, and the protein would be sitting on either side of it and then making cleavages here and here. This enzyme was interesting for other purposes because it also recognizes the degenerate sequence G followed by either purine, then a G, C followed by either pyrimidine, and then a C. And so our collaborators at New England Biolabs, in the general interest of creating new restriction specificities, were interested in reducing the specificity of this. In other words, make it more specific. That is, instead of accepting either purine, accept only one purine. Instead of accepting either pyrimidine, accept only one pyrimidine. And the structure suggested various alterations in the active site residues which we could use to increase the specificity, okay, to allow for the recognition of only one of those nucleotides. And in that particular mutation, that particular residue which seemed to be important was AS246, and it was modified to an alanine. And that point mutation did increase the specificity, okay? So now various, for example, GGG, CTC was more readily recognized than GGG, CAC, okay? So these mutations did increase the specificity, but they also greatly knocked down the activity. So they then carried out a set of experiments in which they did a an error-prone PCR experiment and selected for revertants that had enhanced levels of DNA cleavage activity. So when you selected these revertants with increased activity, the surprising fact was that the mutations were found all over the structure of the protein. And the revertants fall into five categories. You can see that in some cases there's multiple amino acids that were found in the revertants. But if you examine the amino acids for any one of the revertants, in many cases, none of the amino acids that have been changed to create this enhanced level of activity are anywhere near the active site. Okay, so you have this almost miraculous, and of course it's not completely miraculous, but a very surprising sort of action at a distance, if you would. That is that somehow information, chemical modifications, packing changes, something about changing these residues and these revertants had caused a change in the activity in the active site. And this was surprising, although if you look at the literature and look at it carefully, you'll see that there are, in fact, many, many examples of proteins where mutations very distant from the active site have a substantial effect on the activity of the protein. So this became, after doing this experiment, this became, for my mind, sort of a critical kind of question in understanding proteins. How do such distant residues have such an important role? Why should that be? How do those residues, and all the others for that matter, interact to create the function? Clearly, if you make a change out here, okay, its effect on the active site has to be through some kind of interaction, whether it's mediated by several steps or some sort of long-range interaction, but somehow you need some interaction to cause suitable changes. And we felt that this is related to a very old question, and that is the question of why do you need the entire large protein? I mean, all proteins are clearly much bigger than they have to be, seemingly, to hold the active site groups. Why do you need all the rest of the protein? What does it do? What interactions is it responsible for? What properties does all those extra residues confer by interacting with each other? And so this became then the motivation for thinking about this particular problem. So we quickly realized that in order to do this, we would need some new technology. And the technology we came up with had been begun to be worked on by people at Caltech. This diagram is from the work of Steve Mayo and Francis Arnold. And the experiment that they had proposed and had conducted a small trial with is conceptually a very simple experiment, but we believe a very powerful one. And the approach is that of making chimeric proteins. What you do is you figuratively or conceptually divide a protein into its modules So this is beta-lactamase and bind analysis that we won't go into. They have taken this protein and said, this is a module which acts in a partially independent way. Okay, these subunits, these modules, are smaller than the largely independent domains that we're all familiar with, and they're not directly equivalent to the secondary structure. Okay, for example, this one here ends in the middle. This module ends in the middle of that helix. Okay, these modules then provide units that you can use to recombine around. So you could reassemble the protein using modules from different homologs, with the general idea being that the homologous pieces are close enough from the different homologs to be roughly interchangeable. Okay, now not precisely, okay, Mark's question is, it was a very good one, but the idea that you're at least putting a unit in from another protein that functions in another homolog. Now clearly, the better we get this division into these independent elements, in other words, if we can decide the best, the very best, or very very best set, or very most independent set of modules, then the greater kind of interchangeability we're going to have. And we'll talk about some of the things that we've used, some of the analysis we've used to determine what better modules might be. But the point is still that these different homologous parents can then provide substantial sequence diversity. In other words, if you have 100 proteins, you have 100 different sequences, or perhaps 100 different sequences of this particular module. All of those sequences work in at least one homolog. So you know that this is not a completely non-functional kind of sequence. So your sequence diversity in this kind of experiment is channeled along functional lines. You know that, again, that sequence works in one homolog. And since the sequence space of proteins is so very enormous, channeling that diversity into things that you know work in at least one example is a very valuable means of restricting the possible sequences that you could test to those that are most likely to have some particular function and to be able to recombine and give a functional product. Okay, so that's our argument then for why this chimera generation is a useful and powerful experiment. And as you can see, it's conceptually kind of simple. You just break the protein apart and then you take the different modules from different homologs and stitch them back together. And that gives you your chimera that you can then test. It's also a very powerful experiment because there's a number of things that you can do with the library of chimeric proteins. If you are, for example, interested in the interactions that retain structure, that lead to structure, you can test the retention of structure in those homologs and see which combinations of fragments do retain structure. Likewise, you could probe the origins of the stability of the protein and also the origins of the old natural activity. Okay, what combinations of modules still give you the old natural activity? At the same time, you could search for new desired phenotypes, and this is an application of to protein engineering. By putting in new combinations of modules, again, you channel the total range of sequence diversity to those that are more likely to work, but you also provide some substantial sequence diversity for creating new functions. Now, if you think about designing this experiment, you could imagine optimizing this process of chimera generation to do one of these particular things. If you're interested in probing the structure and stability of a protein, you would intentionally recombine between those interactions that are suspected to lead to that structure or to that element of stability. So you could actually carry out an experiment to test whether or not this interaction is important for structure and stability. Likewise, if you wanted to investigate the old activity of the protein, that is the original activity of the protein, you'd probably generally want to maximize retention of the structure and the stability in the library, but you'd want to recombine between the hypothetical activity elements. Okay, and you want to do this because clearly you want to have enough, you want to have most of the chimeric proteins that you're going to test still retain some sufficient structure and stability to have some chance of having activity, okay, but you want to recombine between the various elements that might lead to activity so you can see what's responsible for the activity and what interactions are responsible. And thirdly, if you want to discover new activities, then you probably want some sort of compromise. You want to retain good structure and good stability, but you also want to be generating diverse new sequences. So you want to have some sort of compromise between the various goals that you would use to optimize your experiment. So how do we do this in a little bit more detail? Well, as I mentioned at the very start, we take multiple sequence alignments. This is a multiple sequence section of a hypothetical multiple sequence alignment from proteins from different species. These could be orthologs, that is, they could all have the same function in different organisms, or they could be more generally homologs, paralogs. It doesn't really matter. The basic point is that in at least each one of these, in each, the complete sequence works for each one of these species. And then you then construct the multiple sequence alignment as best you can with the goal of having the multiple sequence alignments represent the equivalent residues in each one of these homologs. So to do this, to conduct this optimization for the goals that I mentioned on the last slide, you want to select a set of parents, and you want to select a set of recombination sites, which we'll also call breakpoints, and together that generates the experiment plan. So we clearly can't recombine all of those species. Also, the number of breakpoints is going to be limited because the total number of chimeras that you get is going to be the number of parents raised to the number of fragments, and that can be an extremely large number. That gets to be an extremely large number very quickly. So you have to make some intelligent decisions about which parents you want to use and where you want the breakpoints to be with the goals for your particular experiment in mind. Clearly, different parents and different breakpoints are going to yield different combinations of sequences, and that's going to and the sequences in the library are going to determine how much information you gain from your experiment, or how many diverse new sequences you create with the potential for novel activities. Yeah,
Les. So far, this is only based on sequence. You don't look at structure.
Some of these interactions that I will talk about on the next slide are actually restrained by structure, but they don't have to be. Okay. We take somewhat the agnostic viewpoint that nature has probably been selecting active sequences at least as effective for a very long time and does so at least as effectively as we can. Okay. So nature's done our work for us. How do we actually optimize the selection for different goals? How do we actually carry out these experiments? And this requires then this new informatic and experimental technology that we've been developing. Okay, so it requires multiple technical capabilities. There's really four areas. I only have time to talk about really the first two. And they are the computational procedures for generating effective experiment plans, what parents do we want to use, what breakpoints do we want to use, with recognition that we have specific goals in mind depending upon what kind of experiment we want to do. And then secondly, efficient experimental procedures for actually assembling the chimeric genes. How do we take these DNA pieces from the different parents, assemble them into chimeric genes? And then by what mechanism do we create the library of these chimeric genes? So then I'll be talking, the rest of this presentation will be about the first two of these technologies. We have also done some work in 3 and 4, but that'll have to be for another day. Okay, so I've shown you this figure a couple times now. And let's begin to explore what it is that we're doing with this multiple sequence alignment. So in this multiple sequence alignment, I've noted three particular kinds of relationships, and I'll name them and provide more details about them later. So there's the, for now, we'll just call them the blue relationship, there's the green relationship, and there's the red relationship. For example, the green shows a predominance of alanine, valine, and isoleucine. That suggests that that non-random occurrence of those three residues in that in those columns suggests that those three residues in some sense interact. Okay. Now, that interaction may be direct and structural, or it may be long range and something that a structural biologist wouldn't necessarily see. Okay. And as I've suggested, at times we would actually restrain this relationship to things that are in contact, but at other times we take a rather agnostic view about it. So if our goal is to provide maximum structure and stability, okay, in other words, if we're trying to, for example, optimize this structure and stability while changing the catalytic elements so as to generate new functions, then we're going to choose our breakpoints to maximally preserve these groups. Okay, so for example, it wouldn't be a good idea to put a breakpoint here, because if we did, we would break up the green group. It also wouldn't be a good idea to put a breakpoint here, because we'd break up the blue group. Okay, if we put a breakpoint here, well, we don't break any groups, so that's generally considered a better alternative. These groups can be either pairs or higher order. Okay, we've developed algorithms and published them for handling groups up to four residue interactions, four-way interactions. That's was published last year at the RECOM RECOM meeting. You would also then, if your goal is to maximize the structure stability, you'd also generally want to avoid parents that lack these groups. If this interaction is important, then perhaps you don't want a protein which is alanine, valine, and leucine. If, on the other hand, you're trying to develop new activities, then you're going to choose your breakpoints so as to provide some compromise between preserving the groups, which means preserving structure and stability, and recombining them to generate new combinations, which means the possibility of coming up with new activities. So in this case, you'd want to select diverse parents, okay, with both canonical groups, so like alanine, valine, isoleucine, and also with diverse groups, like maybe Lu-Val-Val. By recombining those two, you have the potential to gain more variation. algorithms for doing that have been published in the CSB 2007 meeting, and also an algorithm that specifically tries to develop a compromise between maximizing stability and maximizing diversity was submitted to the 2008 RECOM meeting. Okay, so what are those interactions? I apologize for the quality of this slide. It looks fine on my computer at home, but I actually had to do a quick font switch here, and even then it doesn't look so very good. But here are the three kinds of relationships that we're looking at. The first is conservation. Okay, it's a very familiar kind of thing. It's the non-random presence of individual residues at particular positions, in particular columns of the multiple sequence alignment. So in this case, we have a nearly invariant leucine. Okay, all of these but this one are leucine. So that's one kind of sequence relationship that we keep in mind. Second kind of sequence relationship we keep in mind is covariation or coupling. And it's the non-random covariation of residues at particular positions. For example, in these two blue columns, we see that lysine is associated with glutamine, we see that glutamic acid is associated with proline, and we see that cysteine is associated with methionine. This is effectively describes the mutual information between columns. If someone tells me that there's a cysteine in this column, how much does that affect what's going to be in this column? Okay. And the third kind of relationship is what we call hyperconservation. And it's the non-random presence of groups of residues at particular combinations of positions. So if plain old conservation is the non-random presence of individual amino acids, that hyperconservation is the non-random presence of certain sets of amino acids. So alanine, valine, isoleucine, again, is very common in this particular set of three columns. And this hyperconservation is the conservation that's statistically over and above the conservation of individual columns. So, for example, when we look at the frequency of alanine, valine, and isoleucine, we've already divided out the frequency of alanine in this column and valine in that column and isoleucine in that column. So we're only looking then at the combinations, okay, what we call then the hyperconservation. This work has been published in two forms, the hyperconservation work in the Journal of Computational Biology and the covariation or the coupling correlation work in the IEEE ACM transactions. Okay, so let's take a little example. This is a project that my student Nick Fico is doing in collaboration with Joe Davison's group. This is the family of Puri proteins that are homologs that catalyze the same overall step in the de novo synthesis of purines. Overall, no matter what the organism, the step that's catalyzed is the conversion, is the addition of a carboxylate to AIR, amino imidazole ribonucleotide, to form the carboxylated form CAIR. Bacteria, fungi, and plants have distinct mechanisms for metazoan. So the bacteria carry out this reaction as a two-step reaction involving first a carboxylation by pure K, and then a mutase reaction by pure E. The metazoan carboxylases adds carbon dioxide directly to AIR to form the CAIR product. Now, the interesting thing is that these two proteins, the pure E proteins which act as mutases in bacteria, fungi, and plants, and the carboxylase enzymes that directly carboxylate AIR and metazoans are homologs, okay? They are, you can line them up, and you can see their close sequence relationships. But yet they have distinct enzymatic mechanisms. And I bring it up at this point, both because this is going to be an example project that we'll talk about a little later, but also because the relationship, the sequence relationships that I talked about in the last slide have already proven useful to us in helping us to understand the relationships between these homologous proteins. This slide, again, unfortunately doesn't show it very well, but the metazoans are located down here on this plot, in which we've plotted our conservation, our metric of sequence conservation on this axis, and our metric of sequence coupling or correlation on that axis. And you'll see the metazoans form a group down here, and the bacteria form a group over here. And if you were to look at this group on either axis alone, you'd see that they overlap by conservation, they overlap by correlation, but by spreading them out in the two dimensions, you get a very clear distinguishing between these groups, suggesting that this kind of sequence extraction of information from the sequence reflects true structural and functional information, which, as I say, is not identifiable by sequence conservation alone. Okay, so if we have this bioinformatic analysis that helps us decide what parents to use and where to place the breakpoints, how do we actually then make the recombinant genes that we need to test and to learn about and to develop new functions? So the mechanism we've developed for assembling fragments is called spliceo, for specific plan ligation of short overhangs. Of course, we are spliceoing genes together, so it's kind of cute. And it involves the ligation of synthetic or PCR fragments using overhangs that don't change the sequence or restrict the combinations of the chimeras that are going to be generated. The overhangs are planned by a computational procedure that I'll give you some hint of in the next few slides. And also the exact pathway that we use to assemble these fragments is also planned by a computational procedure. If, for example, we had three fragments, each has these overhangs, we could assemble these two first and then this one, or we could assemble these two first and then that one, and that would involve different possibilities for correct or incorrect ligation of the fragments in the desired order. This work was actually largely carried out in the first instance by a Purdue undergraduate, Liz Softoloff, and was published in Proteins, I believe, a year ago. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, we have this series of breakpoints. We've got two example parents here. And suppose we want to break between the asp and the tire, and between the asp and the acin, between the glue and the lyse, and the arg and the acin, and the asp and the ilu, and the asp and the lu. Well, everyone knows that the genetic code has a large number of synonymous codons. Okay, so you can use all the synonymous codons to help you identify alternate methods of coding for each pair of amino acids that span the breakpoint. And then from that list of possible codons or pairs of codons, you can identify the overhangs that are admissible. And by admissible, we mean those that are contain nucleotides that are common to all the parents. Okay. So, for example, this first one over here is actually a simple one, and we're going to, for now, focus on overhangs, which will be three nucleotides long, which will be on the 5' side of the fragment. We'll generalize that in just a little bit. This asp tire and asp acin is easy. We can write down all the nucleotides, all the codons that code for asp, and all those that code for tire and acin, and we don't need a computer to tell us. But we see that we could use the three nucleotides GAT or GAC. Okay, those are common to both these parents. And so we could have a fragment that has this as an overhang. And if we did that, then all combinations of this fragment and this fragment, this fragment and this fragment would have either asp or tire, asp and acin, or asp and tire, all without creating mutations. So all combinations would be possible, and no mutations would be made. Now, it gets a little harder, for example, when you have something like glue, lyse, and arg, acin here. So what we could do here, if we write down all the various codons, the computer would note that we could use AAA, because AAA is present here, and AAA is present in one of the alternative synonymous codons in this parent, too. We could also use GAA. GAA, GAA, okay. So what we've done here is we've constructed the overhang, which uses the fact that this third nucleotide here could be combined with the first two nucleotides here to create an appropriate codon at each possible combination that's still coded for either glue and lyse or glue or acin or arg and lyse. Again, without making any mutations, without restricting which combinations are possible. So the computer does this in a more sophisticated fashion. It runs through all the possibilities and exhaustively searches which overhangs are what we call admissible. Okay, so then we use this procedure then to identify the overhangs. Okay, so then how do we actually chemically generate the overhangs? Well, there's a couple ways we can do it. First of all, we'll describe doing it from PCR fragments. If you have PCR products that are structured like that at the top, that have a clamp sequence at one end and an alternative restriction site, and then the main restriction site that we're interested in, which is the restriction site for SAP1, which recognizes this sequence, and it recognizes this sequence such that this sequence out here is the thing that is recognized by the enzyme, and where it cuts, which is going to be here and here, indicated by the two arrows before they were moved. But these two sites here and here can contain nucleotides of any sequence. So the use of these type 2S enzymes then allows us to create overhangs of any particular sequence. So if we decided that GAA was the useful overhang from the analysis of the previous slide, we can simply construct PCR product that has this SAP1 recognition side, and then instead of that XXX has GAA. Okay. Cleavage will then occur between the N and the X, and after the N here, and that will then give us a fragment suitable for ligation that has GAA right there. Now, SAP1 is an example of what's called a type 2S restriction enzyme, and there are several other restriction enzymes that are available, all of which leave 0 to 5 nucleotide overhangs, and which can have overhangs on either the 5' side or the 3' side. Now, also, if the fragment is small enough to make synthetically, then you can have any overhang you want at all. That's easy. But it should be pointed out that the longer the overhang, the harder it is to find an admissible sequence, because the overhang has to work with all of the parents, and as that sequence gets longer, it's less and less likely that all the sequence of all the parents is going to be coded for by by a single overhang sequence. Now the computer will output the PCR primer pairs for you with matched annealing temperatures, or will output the synthetic sequences for each fragment. And so this allows us to send the sequences off to IDT while we sort of minimize the possibility of human error, which can become quite substantial in a large project like this one. Okay, so those overhangs then are going to be used to determine how to construct the gene. What we're essentially doing is we're ligating fragments that have these overhangs together, and we want to have only one ligation, only the desired ligation. In other words, we want fragment I to ligate with I plus 1 in this order. That's the possibility we've checked here, but we don't want any of the other overhangs to ligate. We don't want this to ligate with this. We don't want this to ligate with the other end of the same fragment. We don't want any of the possible ligations. Okay, so we can actually go in, and if we know the sequence of the overhangs, we can score the possibility of getting the correct ligation versus the possibility of getting incorrect ligations. In the desired ligation, the Watson-Crick complementarity between this overhang and this overhang is ensured by the actual design process, and that's just automatic. But you want to minimize the Watson-Crick complementarity in all the undesired pairs of ligations, and you can do that by either varying the overhangs. Okay, in some cases there were multiple admissible overhangs for each one of these, so you select out the one which minimizes the possibility of incorrect ligation. And you can also alter the fragments that are going to be combined in each step. If I have a series of fragments, like over here, I could choose to combine, say, these two first, as in the solid line, or I could choose to combine these two first, as in the dotted line. And that's going to give me different fragments that are actually assembled at different times. And so that gives me different possibilities of ensuring different opportunities for maximizing the correct ligation and minimizing the incorrect ligation. It's also interesting that earlier steps will effectively hide some of the overhang. So when you ligate this fragment and this fragment, then the overhang that used to be here is now internal, and it won't participate in any more assembly steps. So you can effectively reuse that sequence again and not worry about creating any errors in your assembly. So in general, when you do this, you want to, when you check out the various possibilities, you have to have some target. And so our goals are to minimize the tree height, that is, minimize the number of levels of ligation that have to be done in order to construct the full gene. You also want to minimize the number of ligation steps, and you want to minimize the undesired Watson-Crick complementarity. Now, it turns out that you can do this process efficiently by employing dynamic programming. Dynamic programming is just a computational tool that basically says that if I've already put something together in one way, I don't have to like go back and redo it. Okay, so I have an optimal substructure. If I've decided the best way of putting these two fragments together, then I don't have to reconsider other alternatives when I try to combine this with another fragment. Okay, the substructure has already been determined and it's already optimal, so we don't have to consider any other possibilities for that. But by using dynamic programming, you can sort through a truly enormous number of possibilities. It's amazing how fast the combinatorics increase. You have an enormous number of possible trees multiplied by the number of missable overhangs at each breakpoint. You're quickly sorting through millions and billions of combinations. So to see how this works, here's an example from Puri. This is 9 different species of Puri. And we imagine that we want to do a recombination experiment between these 9 different parents at these 4 breakpoints without any alteration in the residues at the breakpoints. So we find that we can do this, and in fact, the program says that you can do it in one step. If you use this overhang at this breakpoint, this one here, and that one here, then there is very little possibility that they will ligate together in any but the correct way. So it says that I could take those 5 fragments, put them in one tube, and ligate them all together. Now, in this particular case, this is a somewhat easy test case. We have sequence identity at 3 out of the 4. So here we could just use the codon, one of the codons for proline. Here we could use one for methionine, valine. Okay. Here we can't do that. And notice that even here, where we could have used one of the codons for histidine or leucine, the program doesn't choose to do that. The program chooses to combine a codon for histidine and a codon for leucine to create an overhang sequence which is less likely to create inadvertent ligations that we don't want. We're testing the efficiency and specificity of these planned ligations right now. I should note that this system is based upon well-studied principles of ligation. In other words, we sort of understand how ligation reactions work. There's certain ligation reactions you can do, but if you have mismatches and more extensive mismatches, they won't happen. The planning algorithm, however, is flexible enough to allow some alterations based upon experimental experience as we gather it. For example, we may learn that certain overhangs don't ligate very efficiently. So maybe those that are T-rich, for example. So we could just tell the program to not use T-rich. Or it may be that when you get more than 3 or 4 fragments, the statistics just makes it harder and harder to ligate a complete product. So we can tell the program to don't plan any more than 4-way ligations. So that was an easy example. This is a very much harder example. This is 9 diverse beta-lactamases that we want to break into 14 fragments, okay? And this is an incredibly complicated assembly. And in fact, the program tells us, and this is a useful fact to know, that you can't do it without making some alterations, okay? So what we allow the program to do is we allow the program to take additional freedoms in how it assembles the gene, all under user control. We can allow it to make conservative amino acid substitutions. Okay, we can allow it to make small shifts in the breakpoint location. So, for example, this breakpoint is actually shifted 2 amino acids to the right over where we originally desired it. That's what the little arrow up there with the 2 underneath means. And you can see that in several of these cases, we've allowed certain amino acid substitutions to occur. So in order to recombine this parent at this breakpoint, we need to turn the serine into a threonine. And once we do that, then it can recombine with all the others after they've, some of which also have to have mutations made. Okay, so that then is our experimental tool for assembling these chimeric genes based upon our bioinformatically informed plan. Now, how do we actually assemble these variants? What are the tools with which we're actually going to sort of put them together? Well, generally in similar kinds of experiments, these variants are typically generated en masse, meaning you take all the fragments from all the parents, you mix them together in one test tube, you ligate them up, and then you plate them out into some sort of library that you then hope to screen. That has some problems. Effective screening is going to require substantial oversampling to be sure that you statistically get most of the variants. And even then, the oversampling can be many-fold, and even then it assumes that you have a non-biased. If you have a strongly biased library, there's lots of things you may never get, and you won't know that until you're sort of all done. The second problem with this is that if you're doing some screening, large-scale screening by selection, then you're not going to recover any of the inactive variants. And we decided that in this work early on that the inactive variants are probably going to be as informative as the active ones in learning what combinations don't work, okay, what set of interactions are not going to yield activity. So we want to be able then to preserve information from these inactive ones to actually say, this combination does not work. There must be some critical interaction which is missing. Okay. So the alternative protocol then that we've developed and worked on is to assemble each chimera in an individual vessel. Okay. And this allows then precise recovery of each desired variant, both active and inactive. And I love the comment that I got from Clint Chappell when I described this to them. He says, well, then you could actually do an experiment to actually test the hypothesis. And I said, yeah, bingo. And so you could actually, make a single combination of the fragments, know what it is, and test whether that has some activity. Okay, that's much different from relying on one of these statistical selection, which just can't tell you that information. To do this, you need to only mix the fragments from the desired parents in each well, and then repeat that many times over for each desired chimera. And that may seem like a lot of work, and in fact, it would be, but the robot can do this with sort of suitable direction. So what we set about doing was developing some software which outputs a robotic control procedure. Okay. So turns out robots, our Biomech FX and Binley or any other similar robot, will generally take an Excel file of sort of aspirate and dispense commands. Aspirate 10 microliters from well A3 and dispense 5 microliters into well B6 and 5 microliters into well C2. Okay. So then what you need to do is you need to prepare a series of commands to give to the robot, okay, via this mechanism, and let it then combine each one of these fragments that you need in each well. And RoboMix does this. This is our program we've developed, and we call it RoboMix. And it generates this sort of Excel command file from the assembly tree and from knowledge of which parents are located in which original wells. And it's able to generate a complete set of chimeras or any subset that you choose. We can say, we're really not interested in all the combinations. Maybe we're only interested in those combinations that have the first fragment from parent 1 and the third fragment from parent 4. Okay. So it flexibly handles all those combinations. We developed this and tested it out with Larissa's help. And it's now in press in the Journal of Combinatorial Chemistry. I felt we didn't really have time to go into it, but the test was really just so cute, and I really just want to thank Larissa for coming up with this. We'd sort of mentioned the general idea that testing these on real genes would be sort of difficult. It'd be hard to know that you got the right mixtures. But if we mix series of dyes, then we would be able to do that. And so I sort of mentioned this to Larissa, and I said, well, what we need is sort of a series of dyes. And Larissa comes back the next day. Maybe Lev and her had a talk about this. But she came the next day with food dyes. And food dyes are just the trick, because they come in various colors, they're perfectly miscible, and they're perfectly water-soluble. So we actually used this RoboMix program to develop a protocol for mixing a bunch of dyes, tested them out in the spectrophotometer, and we got a correlation between the expected and the observed spectra that was very, very good. And an R factor, an R of 0.995, and essentially perfect correlation. Okay. So then we have the capability of making individual genes in individual wells by mixing gene fragments together by this RoboMix protocol and then ligating them according to the plans that we've developed. Okay, so I'm going to talk then, just close with briefly with discussion of a few experimental systems that we've begun to work on. Here's this Pierre system again, in which we have the bacterial enzyme that acts as a mutase and the metazoan enzyme that acts as a carboxylase. And it's a very useful system for a bunch of reasons. First of all, the phenomenon is interesting. Why should you have two different enzymatic mechanisms in homologous proteins? And why should they split up by metazoans bacteria? What's the need? What are the properties of those two enzymes that would cause such a phylogenetic split? So it's possible. It's also experimentally very useful kind of tool. You can select enzymes that have carboxylase activity on pure K-deficient E. coli. If there's no pure K in bacteria, then the only way of going from AIR to CAIR is by having a carboxylase, which does it in one step. So you can select carboxylase activity then. You can modulate the stringency of the selection by adding small amounts of pure nucleotide adenine. And then this gives you, in vivo, gives you a rough test on the activity of your chimeric product. Conversely, you could select for mutase activity on pure E minus strains. Okay, so if you had a pure E minus strain of E. coli, they would only grow if the pure K product could be converted into pure E, okay, or if AIR could be directly converted into CAIR. And you can counter select for those by screening for no growth on pure K minus strains. In other words, if you're looking for a mutase, pure K has to be there. If you've ended up with a carboxylase by mistake, then it doesn't matter whether pure K is there or not. So we're beginning our investigations in this system by taking the 70s loop, okay, which is a loop on the active side of the protein from several variants. We've listed the parents there. And we're placing them into both human and E. coli backgrounds. There's some evidence that the 70s loop is important or it's at least been proposed by people who've determined the structure of the human pure E. The question we're asking is the 70s loop sufficient to make a mutase into a carboxylase? So can we take this stretch from the mutases, put it into a carboxylase background, okay, or vice versa? Can we take carboxylase and take these sequences from a carboxylase, put them into a mutase background, and get a carboxylase? As the first level experiment, we sort of view this as kind of a proof of concept and something, an initial test. And then at the advanced level, we'd like to mix fragments from several carboxylases and several mutases and see which have which activity. Okay, and by doing so, we hope to be able to define the individual determinants, okay, the individual sequences that have to be there from a mutase or from a carboxylase to get that particular activity, and also the interactions that are required. Okay, in other words, does, for example, a particular mutase fragment from one bacteria work with another mutase fragment from another bacteria, or does that particular interaction not work? A second system that we've been working on involves the cellular localization of NRAS and KRAS. Turns out that the two forms of RAS are localized in different places in cells. That localization is thought to be in the C-terminus. So we've taken the C-terminus part of the protein, broken it apart, developed an experiment plan to recombine N and K-RAS, and then see where these proteins will localize. Third experimental system is a collaboration we're doing with Clint. We've just begun with Clint Chappell. And that is, it's as I'm sure you've heard about from him, the lignin of plants prevent access to the sugars that are needed for fermentation into ethanol. And Clint has been working for a number of years in developing and understanding the lignification process and is now focused on developing a set of lignin modification tools, things that you could use, genes that you can modify to change the lignin to make it more accessible for fermentation. Among those lignin modification genes is a large family of biosynthetic P450s that hydroxylate lignin precursors. And we are working with him to take some of those P450s and recombine them to generate novel activities. Just as an example of some of the early analysis we've done, we've looked at the coupling relationships between residues in these biosynthetic P450s, and we've noted that there are both short-range interactions between residues and also quite long-range interactions between residues. Of course, the short-range interactions are somewhat easy to understand. The longer ones are somewhat more mysterious, but yet evolution tells us that the presence of a particular residue here has a non-random effect on a residue up here. Why that is, maybe we'll actually be able to find out by taking this region from one homolog, taking this region from another homolog, and seeing if they work together or what properties might be altered in them. This is just a notice, an advertisement that if you have an experimental system for doing this, we are more than interested in talking. It requires a well-developed expression screening and selection system. Okay, so you do need to be able to express these chimeras efficiently and to be able to screen them for what you want. You need a set of homologs. Okay, and you need those set of homologs for two reasons. You need to discover sequence relationships, and you also need them to serve as a set of parents for recombination. Some things that you might want to do if you have these two things, maybe you desire new activity. We think that some areas that are particularly interesting are green synthetic chemistry, novel chemistry, bioenergy, and external and internal biological modifiers. That is either things that are expressed internally that change biological response or external compounds, drugs, toxins, etc. Or perhaps you have a basic investigational question. That is, you want to know not only what determinants are responsible for some function, which you could find out by doing site-directed mutagenesis, okay, but you also want to know what interactions are responsible. And you can't find out that by this kind of standard tools of structure function studies. So then I'll just conclude with this bigger picture that I've hinted at before. These questions that we're probing with these technologies are really old genetics questions. Okay. So, for example, it's a very common experiment in genetics to make a point mutation or make some mutations in a region or even just conduct a single swap, take some fragment and put it into a new background. And if you find a loss of phenotype, then that implies that residue or region is a required determinant. Okay, it's something that you need, and if you change it, you no longer get activity. Okay, and this is logically an experiment that's been done thousands of times in the literature. Now, it doesn't tell you whether that required determinant acts alone or whether it works by some interaction. You don't know. All you know is it's required in some way. Okay, on the other hand, if you make a mutant, either a point or some regional mutant, or make a small swap, and you gain a phenotype, that suggests that that residue or those that region is somehow sufficient. And I put sufficient in quotes because when you're dealing with proteins, nothing is ever really sufficient. It's always really working in that background. But nonetheless, in some sense, it is sufficient. That new phenotype is gained just by that new element. Either alone or by interaction. Now, if you begin to make multiple changes, and this is what we're talking about here, making multiple changes, multiple swaps, okay? In fact, if you construct the complete chimeric library, you've made all the possible swaps that you can make with that breakpoint. And that tells you whether determinant is acting alone or by interaction, okay? Is it really sufficient to just have that one thing in there? Okay, no matter what the background is, or does that one thing that you've added have to interact with something else in the background in order to get activity? This is the kind of experiment that will allow us to answer those kinds of questions. I've given this a name. I kind of like this name. It's called, I call it intramolecular epistasis, where epistasis in classic genetics is the interaction of two alleles. This is epistasis acting inside a single molecule. And if you, you know, if you carry out these kinds of experiments in the extreme, in the complete combinatorial sense, then potentially you can identify all the interacting parts with the assumption that they actually are polymorphic in the thing that you're in the set of parents that you've chosen. Clearly, like any genetic experiment, if something's not polymorphic, you're not going to see any difference. Okay, but if you're if they're polymorphic and you carry out all the swaps, then in principle, at least you could identify all the parts that interact that are required for activity. So that's really then one big picture question. How do we extend beyond the sort of classic genetics, classic structure function studies, and using these tools? And then the second big picture question is, are we modeling a natural evolutionary process by this kind of recombination? And I'm really not sure. I suspect probably not, but it is interesting to think about at least a little bit. First of all, these are not natural alleles that are being recombined, right? So in other words, if I take puree from Homo sapiens and puree from bacteria, those aren't natural alleles which would normally have a chance to recombine with each other in nature. Well, that's good and bad. If you're looking for new functions, you want to recombine things that you wouldn't have seen before, okay? But it doesn't really reflect what goes on in nature. However, there probably are several cases where a similar combination between such diverse parents could be possible. And I imagine some situations like recombination between a gene and a pseudogene. Genes and pseudogenes can be quite divergent, so you might then carry out that kind of recombination which would have the potential to yield large changes in the recombinants. If you have a cell that's multiply infected with phage or virus, then you can have recombination among viral genes. And this might be a mechanism by which viruses then can evolve quite rapidly because they are actually recombining very diverse sequences. If you have several pieces of DNA that have been promiscuously transferred into a prokaryote, that's a possibility of getting this kind of wide-ranging recombination. Similarly, in eukaryotes or any species that accepts retroviruses often carry additional genes with them, so you can get this potential for recombination between two very diverse sequences. So then the final question would be, if these processes are important, okay, then we may have to ask ourselves, do they reflect a significant fraction of recombination in real molecular evolution? In other words, I sort of doubt that the kind of recombination we're doing here reflects real natural evolution, but maybe so. And in fact, maybe most of the more important jumps have actually been carried out by recombination between two quite diverse sequences. And in that case, then the process that we're talking about here could also be used to model and understand what might be going on in some of these rapidly evolving systems. So I, at this point, want to thank all the people who've worked with me on this. This work has been the product of an extensive collaboration with a number of people. I've already mentioned Joe Davison, I've mentioned Larissa, but in particular, I want to point out the very important role and the very important and close collaboration between myself and Chris Bailey Kellogg at Dartmouth. I want to thank him in his absence and thank him for probably some of the most intellectually stimulating times I've had as a scientist. And I think together we've put it together a system which will allow us then to understand, to get at some questions in proteins and their structure and function, and get at some practical applications which have not been possible at all up until now. So thank you for your time. Glad to take any questions. Any questions about what we do, Carol?
So this selection for where you cut, you described it in terms of your blue, yellow, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then you kind of went off to the far right-hand side and said, well, this one won't interrupt any of these.
Right. At least any of those that we've actually plotted here. I mean, there may be that, you know, this white column interacts with something way down there, but we're assuming this is the set.
I'm missing some like basic thing, which is roughly every 20 residues I'm going to cut, and I don't want to do this local in a local sense. That is, you're always, I presume your greens are going to expand the full sequence.
They do. These relationships.
So if you don't cut between any greens, you won't cut anywhere. What I'm saying?
Well, there's better and worse. Okay. So, yes, you know, this is a simplified example. This is a cartoon for seminar purposes. In reality, of course, these relationships extend across the whole sequence. Okay? And there's going to then be a network of interactions across that whole sequence. Okay. Now, in fact, there are almost no places where it's absolutely safe to cut, but there are places that it's better and places that it's worse. Okay, so, you know, you'll see that if you sort of plot these out, you'll see that there are some parts of the protein that are quite dense in these interactions, and some parts of the sequence that are quite dense, and other parts that are quite a bit sparser. And so clearly you're going to want to cut in those sparse regions.
So I also am guessing that, you know, one question would be, okay, once you see where the selections are optimal based on this algorithm, where are they in the structure? But maybe it doesn't really matter where they are in the structure. Is that the argument?
That's something. That's something of our argument.
I mean, for example, you don't want to cut in the middle of the helix most of the time when you're trying to engineer things. Right?
Well, that's not so clear. I'll refer back to this analysis, which Steve Mayo did. This is a decomposition of beta lactamase. In their work, which they call schema, they look at sequence changes slightly differently than we do, but their sequence changes also are only related to things that are in contact. So their groupings are structurally based and contact dependent. Okay. Even so, they say that the way to modularize this protein is to cut in the middle of that helix. That, for whatever reason, the residues on this side of the cut are perhaps making more interactions within that module, and the residues on the other side of that cut are making more interactions within the module that it belongs to. So that there are, you know, a relatively small number of cross-modular interactions. And the fact that it occurs in the middle of the helix, well, occurs in the middle of the helix. Actually, helices don't make very many interactions with themselves anyway. You'll get, you know, an occasional long side chain sort of reaching up, well, actually usually reaching down because of the way the side chains point, but you know, it, there's not all that many, you know, if you examine the structure. So,
have you tried to apply your approach to this sequence?
Yes, we have.
Fragments.
Yes, we have. We get a different set, and who is right? Well, only experiment will tell. But one of the experiments that we have planned is to run the Mayo schema and make a set of recombinants by their method, make a set of recombinants with the goal of optimizing stability by our method, and then actually count the number of stable and active proteins in the chimeras. So, yeah. Okay. Any questions? Well, thank you again. I appreciate you all coming and listening.